Hey Debbie, how are you doing?
I am thrilled to be talking to you this morning. I have been such a huge fan of your work as a music video director for decades. And
thanks very much.
And now to see what you have done as a feature director, wow.
Oh, thanks a lot. Jeez, this is a great start for an interview.
When I knew that you were directing Siege, I was very curious to see how you would make the translation, because certain kind of energy that it takes to up the energy in a short amount of time, convey emotion, and tell a story. And that's very much when you have an event like Siege, you need those same elements. So I was so looking forward. I was so looking forward to see what you did, and you surpassed every expectation I had from a directorial standpoint.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you. That's great to hear. I mean, I've been making TV commercials for quite a chunk of time in the middle, and so you get used to certain aspects of the directing, you know, like running a crew, even if it's a very big crew, and, you know, special effects and CGI and how it all affects how you shoot. So, the real challenge for me was actually working with the actors and telling a story over an hour and a half instead of over, you know, 3-minute music video, or, you know, it's just a different, like, in music videos and on TV, we're all fucking on crack, you know, we're just manic, and it's all over in 3 weeks and next, whereas with feature films, it's sort of much slower, a big long burner, you know.
And of course, you didn't pick a small story to tell when you're making your feature debut. This is a very intricate story, a very personal story, but also a very historical story. I mean, you didn't pick something easy.
I mean, I know you're absolutely right. You know, I could have just made a three-hander horror movie and just put my finger in the water. But unfortunately, you know, what happened was I discovered the story by accident, then realized that nobody had heard of it, then realized when I started snooping around that actually loads of people knew about it, but no one spoke about it. It wasn't even an elephant in the room. It was beyond that. And then when I realized the injustice of it, the travesty of it, I just kind of, like, it sort of became my cross. I had to do it. So, I wouldn't say it's a smart movie to make as your first feature film, but unfortunately it fell on my shoulders to tell this untold story, and so I just stuck with it. It took me 7 years to get it made.
Wow.
But, you know, so that's kind of how it happened. It's not a traditional first movie for sure, you know.
How did you stumble on to this story?
Yeah, I mean, the Congo crisis would have been something that people would have known about, although it's not one of those proxy wars that were a lot of attention given to, like, say, the Vietnam War was. But how I found the story actually was, I was reading a book called Guns for Hire, which is the history of the mercenary soldiers, and starts with the Pickertons in Glasgow moving to America, and how they ended up policing the railroads for the government that was going for hire. They hunted down Jesse James, then they got into arms dealing in the Civil War, and then it takes you right through the whole history of mercenary soldiers, i.e. guns for hire, right up to modern day Yemen and Afghanistan. And right in the middle of the book there was just this one page about these small group of Irish soldiers that came up against a bunch of formidable mercs and kicked their arses. And I was like, hang on a second, I never heard of this. And then I started digging around, and then, like, people in the army would say, oh yeah, Jadaville, oh, we don't talk about Jadaville. And I was like, well, hang on a second, start talking about it. And then I found an actual book that had been released called The Siege at Jadaville, but it pretty much came and went, and no one really picked up on it. So I just optioned the book and started the whole, you know, journey.
How did you find Kevin to write your screenplay?
The way I found Kevin was, I was kind of effectively the owner, you know, the producer of this, although I'm not really a producer, but you find yourself doing producery things at that early stage. And I wanted it to be a movie. I didn't want it to be a little parochial film. And Ireland's a small country. We have a lot of soft money here. And a lot of the Irish writers are used to writing movies that are inside the sort of realm of $500,000 to $2 million budget, because that's just the reality here on the ground. And I was living in LA, and I started trawling, and I found Kevin, and technically he's from Donegal, so he's Irish. And so I approached Kevin, because I knew I didn't want any parameters on his brain. I wanted him to just go at us, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I found he's based in L.A.
So how do you, once you've optioned this, obviously you immediately started thinking of how you're going to tell this story from a visual standpoint. So how did you go about designing your visual construct? Because what you and your cinematographer, Nicholas Summerer, have done, the film is beautiful. Yeah, it is. It's gorgeous. But you have a very distinct design to what you're doing, with contrast between the lighting with the battle, and then basic exteriors, and then interiors. And what you guys do with that South African lighting is gorgeous.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a couple things. One is, like, I'm originally a photographer by trade, so I would have DP'd all my own work as in videos and commercials. So that meant I had a very good understanding of how to approach a story visually. So although I wasn't interested in being involved in that because I wanted to work just with the actors and on the story, I was able to develop a good vernacular with Nick, who's just a beautiful cinematographer. And when I saw his work, what I noticed about each of his movies was that you each had a different visual treatment, but the treatment suited the story so brilliantly that I went, okay, I kind of knew that this guy, you know, could pretty much tackle anything. So he wasn't just the guy who does that kind of lighting. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so we talked at length, mostly what we talked about was how this film has to feel really honest, because it's a true story and we want the audience to never not believe what they're seeing. So there needed to be a sense of realism. So that immediately put us on kind of standard lenses, slightly wide lenses, but nothing too glamorous or, you know, long lensy, you know, and slick. So by choosing those lenses, that put us in the action. And so then I just went, you know, the difference between the two is that when we're in the action, we need to feel we're in it and experiencing it. And then with the drama, the geopolitical drama, I just wanted there to be a little sort of edginess to it, a little tension that kept things going, which would not be dissimilar, say, to some of the green grass kind of movies where the camera's just on your shoulder. So a lot of the geopolitical stuff is shot handheld, but just loose, not kind of swinging around, but just a little bit loose to keep that edginess going in the dramatic stuff. And then in terms of the lighting, I mean, we were truly kind of blessed, because the location we picked and the time of the year in South Africa was, it's the winter there, and in the winter it's basically dry, it never rains, and it's sunny, but pretty icy in the morning and then gets warm and then gets icy at night. So every day our sun would come up on the button and there would be no clouds in the sky at all, and then it would go down, and by the end of the day we'd stirred up so much red dust from the earth into the air that we just got this kind of Terrence Malick-y hour at the end of every day with this kind of beautiful light. And so we just went, you know what, fuck the continuity, like, let's just shoot the beautiful light, you know. So, you know, that's kind of how we approached it. Every day we were ready for that nice light, and so we got those nice shots, you know, that kind of nice light. And that's really how we approached it.
I mean, and the lighting, and that silty touch to the lighting is just glorious. And it really comes through in your interiors with your use of color, because the color palette it's very basic, but you pick up so many shadings of your browns, your greens, that it really, there are moments that look like it, very painterly, very beautifully done.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, well, what I did was I went to the production designer and with a palette of colors. You picked up on that very nicely, actually, because I went in with a sort of palette of colors and said, these are the only colors I want to see in the movie. So that way, he stripped out any of the other colors. So we didn't have it wasn't panchromatic. We stripped out certain colors. And we mostly stayed in the green, blue, beigey kind of warm color area. And then the odd red would ping in that, you know, and that was pretty much how we did it. And that helped me with the period of it, because it was 1961, you know, so it helped to give it a little bit of a period look by stripping out some colors.
Mm-hmm. How challenging was it? Because I look at some of the attack sequence, the various waves of attacks, and you've got a couple scenes in there, it's like all I could think of, it took me right back to Cy Enfield's Zulu. As, you know, the troops are massing and they're coming at you in full force. You know, Roman gladiators. I mean, just, did you have influences that you called upon to design some of those site-specific things?
It's funny, that came up as a question at the BAFTA screen the other night in London, but, you know, I grew up on movies like The Alamo and Zulu and Spartacus and all those movies, because that's what you saw as a kid on the TV. I certainly didn't need to look at those movies to take influences. But you know, the original story, the battle in Jadaville was quite a skirmish, and it was dotted around the place. But we managed to get a schematic drawing by Quinlan from the family of the buildings and the road that went through the buildings. That was technically the compound. So we basically built the compound exactly as it was in real life, and it's with real bricks and mortars. You could live in it.
Wow.
And then we just plumbed it full of explosives. But it was a little bit more skirmishy, and I did the Zulu thing really to give it a cinema, you know, to make it more cinematic and for the audience, and also it helps with the geography. I think one of the things I noticed, like you mentioned Roman gladiators, but I always remember in Spartacus the way the slaves appear on the hill above the Romans, and that was the first tactic, and that was what it was like okay, they've got the advantage. Then the Romans, all the different legions, they're like pieces of the chessboard all connect up, and then you see their might. And then the slaves roll out these big rolls of huge giant rolls, and you're like, what the fuck's going on now? And then they set them on fire, and you're like, and although it's a very short sequence in the film, I always remembered as a kid, like, these tactics of the battle is what really made it exciting. So mm-hmm. We did that in the movie. We basically, I sat down and we designed each battle sequence, and then I got a military advisor to look at what we were doing and say, okay, well, actually, you wouldn't do that. They'd be more likely to all get down or lie down, or they would more charge from here, or there would be two layers. He put a polish on it, and then he was there on the day. And he would have also been boot camping all the actors. So they were in boot camp, they were reenacting sections of the battle so that they were training specifically. So it all just, all the bits came together. So when we were shooting, it was really just about where do you put your camera and let's go.
Wow. Well, it definitely shows on screen, Richie, because those battle sequences are absolutely fabulous. Truly fabulous.
Can I bring you home with me? Can I?
I'll go anywhere with you, Richie. I'll go anywhere. You know, how was it a blessing or a burden for you as a filmmaker to know that so many of these men from A Company are still alive and their families are alive, and here you are telling their story?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in a way, I couldn't really spend every day worrying about the responsibility of that, because I have to just worry about doing a good job.
Mm-hmm.
Once the story was clear in the script, that's the story I was trying to tell. That's the reveal of what happened to them. I really wouldn't know. I couldn't. And actually, one of the things I did was I delivered, although I met with a lot of them, and I met with the Quinlan family many, many times, I was very careful never to share the script with them ever. In fact, the first time they ever saw anything was the movie itself when they came to the premiere, because I didn't want them getting embroiled in all of that, because there's a lot of politics to go on within the army, and if somebody is seen in a bad light, and then, say, for example, someone had been seen to have helped me and saw that, then they could get into a bit of a hot spot with, you know, so for example, Leo Quinlan, there's certain officers that don't come out brilliantly in the movie, and Leo would know them and their family, so if he became involved in the process of the movie, then he sort of becomes a target. So I deliberately kept all the army away from any involvement in notes or the process. All I did was just interview them, absorb them, and I just took it upon myself to make the right choices for them.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Oh, it makes perfect sense, and I think that was a very smart way to approach this, because so many filmmakers, when you do have the people, you know, alive and living and walking around, and you want to use them, but at the same time, they'll go too far and want to appease the real-life individuals and sacrifice the film.
Yeah, pretty much. And also, they don't understand the process, how you make a movie, and it's very different. There's been a few documentaries about this subject, so they've had their documentary. This was a movie, and it needed to entertain an audience and hopefully intrigue them and educate them, but it's still a movie, you know? And so I had to compress time. And, you know, luckily enough, I sort of think we managed to not have to bridge any facts in the movie with a fix-it, you know, like a makeup fix-it to help the flow of the story. We were able to, it took a long time to find a true path through it that told a story that would stand up to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the hardest challenge, really, was finding that.
So I have to ask you, because it is a movie and entertainment, you bring in Mark Strong, thank you very, very much for that, and you also cast Jamie Dornan. I never would have thought of Jamie in the role of Pat Quinlan. What led you to these two actors?
Well, I mean, Mark is just an incredible actor, and, like, you know, I watch movies that Mark is in just because he's in them, because he makes such good choices, and he, you know, I think he's that kind of an actor that, you know, I think a lot of people probably feel the same way about him, and a lot of times people go, holy shit, that was Mark Strong, you know. And Mark loves to be a chameleon. He loves to metamorphosize into a character. He really loves doing that. So when he came up as a possibility, I just dived on him. I was like, yeah, Mark, that's great. And, like, I just went at it so hard that nobody even challenged that, you know. Jamie was the reason why Jamie for me was the guy, was because I'd seen him in The Fall, and, you know, his performance is quite sublime in that, and it's a tricky part to play, and he does it so brilliantly. But he had two things going on for me. One was he had a kind of a Steve McQueen factor, which means that even without opening his mouth, you just want to watch him.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a very rare thing, and if you've got it, you know, you're a lucky man or a lucky woman. And and plus, he wasn't that well known, so I just sort of felt if a very well known established actor, you know, played the part, it might take away from the audience and honesty thing I was talking about early on, whereby this is a true story. And at the time, he was fairly much unknown.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, 50 Shades flipped that. But at the time, I just thought he was the perfect choice. And he was Irish, and I met him, and he really got the story, and he was really passionate about it. And that's kind of what you want going into a movie with an actor, I think, is someone who basically believes that strongly in the story. And he was all those things. So for me, it was kind of a no-brainer, and I just feel really lucky that I got him.
I mean, he does an amazing job, and I love the contrast that you have in the energy levels between Mark's character, you know, of Conor O'Brien, and then Jamie as Pat Quinlan. They're like opposite sides of the coin, and it plays so beautifully on screen. I have to ask you about your score in Joe Trapanese, Rich.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the score is absolutely beautiful. I'm a huge fan of Joe's work. I've interviewed him before. What led you to him for your scoring? And of course, your end, music, you have those little Irish lilts that are included in there, reminding us, you know, who these men are.
Yeah, Joe, I mean, we had, you know, there was a couple of people put on the table. Netflix very generously said they were when they saw the cut, they kind of said, look, we're prepared to pay more money to get the right guy. So we had it. It opened up our choices, and we had a couple of pretty much world class composers, and Joe was one of them. And we talked. Myself and the producer, Al Maloney, we talked to all of them, and Joe really resonated for me and for Alan. And he also, because I come out of music videos and that world, and TV commercials where I've often found the music, and I've worked with a lot of bands. Joe had worked with Daft Punk, he had worked with NWA, so I kind of knew that he would have a very open-minded approach to the score.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're making an action film, the kiss of death is if you start telling the audience how to feel. So it's sad, so sad music, so here's an action piece, so let's do action music. And so I talked to Joe a lot, and we talked actually about the movie Bullet, the Steve McQueen movie Bullet, with the famous car chase. And if you watch that movie, Lalo Schifrin's score is all of the following each other, as the bad guys follow Steve McQueen and him follow them. But the second the car chase explodes, all the music stops, and it's the music then is the sounds of the engines and the gear changes and all that. And so we talked about that and went, you know, we want to build tension, but we don't want to be telling the audience, okay, this is action, so action for action, music's sake. And Joe really got that and loved that idea. So then it was really just about writing music, which is what he does. And he would just write music, and I would just go, holy shit, this is so cool.
Well, it paid off. I mean, it's just wonderful. I mean, Richie, I can't thank you enough for talking to me this morning. I mean, this has been an absolute delight. And I really hope that you are going to make some more films.
I really hope so, too.
I mean, beautiful. Job well done, Richie, really.
All right, girl. Very nice talking to you.